And we're Kirby's Kids.
Hey, go! The Kids Talk.
Can't wait for Comic-Con in July? Then join us for WonderCon in March.
Friday through Sunday, March 29th through the 31st at the Anaheim Convention Center.
WonderCon in March. WonderCon has comics, anime, gaming, masquerade, a giant exhibit hall, and special guests, including Gail Simone,
Dustin Nguyen, Ashley Eckstein, Marv Wolfman, and Hugh Howie.
Along with special TV and movie presentations. WonderCon, March 29th through the 31st at the Anaheim Convention Center.
Welcome back, kids, and thanks for listening as we are celebrating our experience at WonderCon 2024. This is Angus, and I'm here with JJ. JJ, how are you?
I am doing great, Angus. Thanks for having me on. This is becoming quite the spring tradition for us.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And I'm glad I've now made it part of the spring tradition. For you, it definitely was the case last year, as you got to attend WonderCon while I was at GaryCon last year. So it was actually great to be back in the SoCal area and able to head up for the day for WonderCon. And JJ and I, we split the days. I went up on Friday and JJ went up on Saturday. And I think both of us would say that it was quite an enjoyable experience. And I want to once again thank Comic-Con International for recognizing the Kirby's Kids podcast as press. And we were invited to cover the WonderCon experience here for all of our listeners. So, JJ, what were your general impressions of the con?
So, overall, it seemed like for my day, attendance was down a little bit from what I could just experience in the exhibit hall. Now, I think that had a lot to do with the weather, which I'll dive into a little bit. Obviously, that's not anything that WonderCon can control, but it did have an impact on my day.
Yeah, and I'd have to say that Friday, and we chose Friday to go up, I took with me my daughter, her fiance, and also my son. And we chose Friday to go up because we figured, okay, this would be the least heavily attended day, weekday, and you know, maybe some folks would take off for Friday and go there. And we were pleasantly surprised with regard to the amount of people there at the con when we originally arrived. We got there early, and with the exhibit floor opening up at 11, we were queued up in line just a little bit before 10, and we were some of the first people into the exhibit hall. And that was a fantastic experience. But as we kept walking the exhibit hall, more and more people from lunchtime onward, I'd have to say from noon to 1 p.m. onward, you really started to see the groundswell. And by the time we left, as the exhibit hall was closing up, there were quite a few folks there for the evening's activities. So from that standpoint, I think WonderCon should have been pretty happy with respect to the attendance on Friday. And we did not have a weather issue at all, fortunately for us. I think you all had to battle getting up there on Saturday morning. And that was quite the harrowing experience for anybody who lives in Southern California. When it rains here pretty heavily and you get flash flood warnings, that's the equivalent of it snowing in the Midwest. Driving is always quite a harrowing experience because folks just forget how to drive in inclement weather out here. It's pretty amusing, but at the same time, you got to be on your guard. Glad to see you made it back unscathed, JJ. We arrived there on Friday and entered the exhibit hall around 11. And spent, I'd say, a good 6-7 hours in the exhibit hall, all told. It was really cool to see the con through a younger generation's eyes. This was the first time both my daughter, my son, and my daughter's fiance had ever been to a comic book convention. So it was great for them to be able to walk the aisles, see all the different types of vendors that are there. And a big difference between WonderCon and Comic-Con is it's about, what would you say, JJ, in that exhibit hall, about maybe 2/3 of the size of Comic-Con?
Yeah, I think that Comic-Con is just a little bit deeper and like you said, about 1/3 again longer.
Yeah, and I noticed some of the vendors and exhibitors that are at San Diego Comic-Con relegated to the fringe of that convention floor. Some of them took a more prominent presence there towards the center. I did recognize some of the vendors, which was great. And they were all very, very high quality. And the biggest thing that stood out to me was the fact that there was only one of the larger, and I put that in air quotes, publishers there. And that was IDW. There was plenty of small publishers represented. Of course, talent was there, both in Artist Alley as well as writers having their own booths there. And the feel of this comic book convention was in some ways, and I'm not all, I personally am not all that experienced here, but I had many folks around me say, who are very experienced comic book convention goers, that this has more of a feeling of a throwback convention, meaning something that you would have seen in the 90s or early 2000s. It's not overproduced. It has a good representation of golden, silver, bronze age, and modern day comics represented through vendors being there and comic book stores and shops. Also, CGC being there for all of the grading and authentication and the slabbing that is put together on the collectible comic book. So that was good to see that. Lots of artists there and renderings of not only original artwork from comics, but at the same time, other artists there that have done stylistic variations on themes. For instance, my son and daughter bought prints from a vendor on the floor who did things in a Japanese art style. Everything from Star Wars characters to JoJo's Bizarre Adventures. So,
nice.
Yeah, Jonathan Joestar was there. And also something from Evangelion, too. So it was very cool to see this mashing up of people being inspired by comic book art, also producing art. T-shirt vendors there, of course. My daughter picked up some video games from some vintage video game vendors who are also in the hall too. So this really was a celebration of comic book and geek culture as much as it was, yes, paying tribute to the foundation of comic book conventions through having those comic book vendors there and present. Because the other thing, JJ, which I was also taken with, was the dedicated gaming section here. Yes. At WonderCon. I know that there was some also at Comic-Con, but I think some of that was maybe a little more spread out in the various hotels and things of that nature, as where there prominently on the exhibit floor at WonderCon was a dedicated gaming area where my daughter's fiance actually played a game of Starfinder, learned to play, and he was there. And he's a big Pathfinder fan and just wanted to see, hey, what was this variation on this theme and the mechanics? And he was very, very impressed with what he saw there, and he felt he most likely would end up playing the game. So there's really a lot for folks to take in and experience just on the exhibit floor alone.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head there that there's a lot of variety. It is very much pop culture. There's a nice mix of gaming, just general geekery, and a more comics than you can shake a stick at. So while you're exactly correct, there were none of the large or really large publisher, no Marvel, no DC. There really was a proliferation of indie, indie publishers, all the way down to, kind of like the equivalent of the mom and pop shops, where it's one or two creators self-publishing, their books. So it's a lot of variety. Anything in particular besides the items that they purchase really catch their eye?
What caught their eye were just the volume of opportunities to see things that they had never seen before, particularly when it was in the vintage comics area. because unless you are fortunate enough to have, and we are here actually in the San Diego area, to have actually several comic book shops that do specialize in Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, collectible type of comics, that is a whole different experience to see the volume there to select from and begin to understand comics history and where it all came from outside of the big two. The other thing which stood out, and this was the only larger publisher that was there, IDW had a booth there. And IDW being in close proximity, just down here in San Diego, till they go up to Anaheim, it's not that far of a journey for them. And there they were promoting Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which my son immediately globbed onto because we had gone to see Mutant Mayhem in the theaters last summer. And it's like, oh, okay, so that's right. So this started out as a comic book series ever before it was a TV series, before there was ever films, da, 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 da. So that gave us opportunity to kind of delve into the history of that iconic indie book that got its start. So that was cool to see. Huge compliment to WonderCon was that there was enough room to navigate down the aisles, not feeling closed in, and plenty of the vendors had enough space to show their wares and engage with all of the attendees. So they were impressed with that, tremendously so. But I'd have to say at the end of the day, after 6 hours of being on the floor, they just were exhausted and quite frankly, overwhelmed. And they felt that they maybe saw, if they were lucky, half of the exhibit floor, all told.
Yeah, there's so much to see there. This is where I really appreciated the bookmarking feature in the WonderCon app, the app provided by Comic-Con International with all of the events and vendors and goings-on in app format. So much easier to pull out as you're trying to find something as opposed to looking at a paper, you know, magazine listing of everything. But that ability to bookmark vendors and then just say, okay, I'm going to the next one and here's its number, and you just walk straight there, just absolute time saver.
Yeah, and JJ, you were really valuable to us advice-wise, letting us know about that whole quick list feature after we had starred vendors that we wanted to go see. And then you designate a starting point and the app basically maps out a route for you. Yep. It was fantastic. Oh my gosh. It was really, really great. So I'm sure they all got to see the essential vendors that they wanted to go see, mm-hmm. but at the same time, there were a lot that they didn't even have on their list. They were going by and going, wow, this is amazing. This is cool. I mean, mm-hmm. my daughter's fiance, he was blown away by the amount of gameplay, RPG, ephemera dealers there and dice people. And he ended up picking up some dice while he was there too. And, you know, that was great. So I love how, from a cultural perspective, you had all of these adjacent activities to comic books also celebrated there. And that was a cool thing to experience. And they were all equally impressed with that.
Yeah, very nice.
So JJ, what was your experience in the exhibit hall on Saturday? Since you had mentioned that it maybe wasn't as attended because of the weather as much as it had been last year. But, you know, Saturday is known to be one of those high traffic days for a con.
Absolutely. And so we did see traffic in the hall pick up over the course of the day. So I was in the hall during three distinct points. One was early after it opened, and I was in it for about a good 2.5 hours or so. Then I was in there kind of in between a few of my sessions when we had a little bit of downtime. And then finally, we were there until it closed, right? We were there at the end of the day. So beginning and end of the day was the most room. Middle of the day was very packed. But I still felt like it was a little less than I remember it from, you know, years past, especially because the majority of what I was seeing in the hall were cosplayers walking about. Now, that was probably due to the fact that they generally congregate right outside the entrance to the convention hall. There's like a little pseudo amphitheater space there where folks can pose and get their pictures taken and all of that. Well, the weather was pretty poor for Southern California, and there was a lot of rain throughout the day, and so they were constantly moving back in into the main hall space. So either the ground floor was just, you know, overflowing with cosplayers, so getting through like over to the escalators to go up to a lot of the seminar spaces was a challenge, and then getting through the hall was a little challenging at times, especially because cosplayers tend to have large costumes. So
yes,
it makes it a little bit of a challenge. But even then, no catastrophes. I didn't run into anybody, so all was good there. I spent the majority of the time traveling with some friends of mine who had very specific things they wanted to do. And you brought up CGC. Well, one of the first things that my friend Jeff wanted to do is get some of his books graded, and then, as he would call it, bricked or slabbed, right? Where they put it in, they seal it hermetically, and they'll stick a grade on there. So this was so educational. Actually, walking through this process with him, he brought in the books he wanted to get graded. They had all these computers set up where if you didn't have an account, you could set up an account. If you did have an account, then you could start creating a drop-off list, basically. Because that's one of the advantages of the conventions, is it's a place where you can go and hand them your books so that you save a little bit on postage. They're going to get shipped back to you, but you don't have to go through all of the rigmarole of packaging it, insuring it, making sure it's all set. So it was really good. The process was really easy if you were a PC user. So I say this because my friend Jeff is a Mac user, and I have nothing against Macs and Mac users, but when he was trying to use the laptop, it was giving him fits and starts, and it kept activating the right click menu as opposed to the left click, and it was really a nightmare. And so I just said, Jeff, let me go ahead and take care of that for you. So I actually was the one who typed in all the information, submitted the things, and then put it all together. So it's really interesting. You know, you basically create a list of what books you're bringing in, how much you're willing to evaluate them for. Like, you're basically putting insurance on them, right? While they have them, there's a fee associated with that for them to grade it. So we went through all of that, and then once that was complete, we printed out the order, and we physically handed it to somebody. You got a printout of a receipt as you were done. And then they would grade it, put it in the slabs, and then ship them back to them. Overall, the process was really quick. It was really easy. The staff were incredibly helpful. Probably the most challenging things was one of our friends really kept wanting to look at the comic book. Oh, is that giant size X-Men number one? Let me take a look at that. No, we're not opening it for you. is that Metal Men number one with 12 cents on the cover? Yes, it is. Can I take a look? No, we're not opening it.
Nice.
It was like being there with a 10-year-old.
Sure.
It was a very very easy process, and they don't just do comics anymore. They also do all sorts of memorabilia, cards, toys, video games, anything that is a collectible, they can pretty much do, they can do nowadays. As a counterpoint to that, later in the day, we stopped by, I think it was Heritage
Auctions.
Heritage Auctions, yes. Because we wanted to, my friend Jeff wanted to find out, you know, what's the advantage of going through Heritage? And they really know their stuff there. They do work with CGC, but also they were in the business of auctioning comics before CGC got into the business of slabbing and grading comics. So you could go directly to them if you wanted to. You could bring them your whole collection. They would work with you, figure out what's worthwhile, what's not. They could even assist in getting everything over to CGC if you wanted to slab it, because I think in most cases that usually gets folks a higher price. So it as far as that goes, this was an extremely educational visit just to those two vendors alone.
Yeah, I'd say so. I have to admit, I was very impressed with Heritage Auctions when I first encountered them at Comic-Con last year and saw the breadth and depth of what they engaged in and with. I mean, full-blown estate sales for collectors who had rare comic books to studios, actually, that want to sell cells, old animation cells from productions. Mm-hmm. There was an entire Studio Ghibli auction that they were heading up. So it's amazing to see everything that Heritage gets involved with, and for there to be a really nice one-stop shop for at least one data point of the value of some of these things that have, frankly, they were commonplace during our childhood, but JJ's were getting older. Mm-hmm. They're becoming collectibles. Yep. And just to see the value that has to the collector's market is quite the education. So that's really cool that you had that experience. Was there anything else on the exhibit hall that stood out to you?
Well, the majority of my actual shopping was in two places. I'll save the one or two types of places. I'll save one of them for it because it was actually a follow-up to my last seminar that I was in. But the majority of what I did was I went to the different dice vendors. I think I was missing being at GaryCon, so I went to all of the dice distributors. And I found, you know, I don't need more dice.
Right.
But
we never, none of us do, but
darned if I didn't buy more dice.
Yep. Yep.
Dice Envy was probably my one stop where I spent the most money. I bought some four-siders, which had music notes on them. I had never seen music notes used as pips on dice before.
That's cool.
And the four-sider was kind of like a long rectangle with rounded ends.
Mm.
So it could never land on one of the ends. It's always going to land on one of the long sides. So it was really, the caltrops that are the typical D4, you know, are hard to pick up. These are so much nicer.
Nice.
So I really love that design, and I love the music notes on it. I also picked up, I don't think it was at Dice Envy, it was at another place like right nearby, a set of small metallic dice and a teeny tiny set of miniature dice, just because they look so cute in the little tin. Because I'm like, oh my God, I could have a whole set of polyhedral dice in this little tin. So if I ever wanted to bring them with me somewhere inconspicuously, I could. But it was really cool. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed seeing all the stuff that was there. It was just a great time.
Very cool.
I'll save the other part till afterwards, but I think you had gone to some seminars, did you?
Yeah, I did. I did. I was able to get into two seminars on Friday, and it's just because I was balancing my time between first-time congoers and my daughter, my future son-in-law, and my son, and then also my desire to attend some of the seminars, as they felt that because this was their first con, their time would be more well spent down on the exhibit floor. And I wasn't about to argue with them on that one either. I just said, hey, look, for a future one, when I bring you back, you know, I would highly encourage you to go to some of the seminars. So the first seminar that I went to, session one, was, hey, look, it's the Harvey Kurtzman at 100 panel. And nice. This one, yeah, this one I was really excited about because I was a big Mad Magazine kid growing up. That was one of the few things that my parents could get me to actually read initially. So they got me a subscription to Mad Magazine, and I absolutely loved it. And Art Spiegelman called Harvey Kurtzman the single most significant influence on generations of comics artists. As founder and editor of Mad and other revolutionary mid-century humor publications, Kurtzman was a postmodernist decades before the term was coined. We had Michael Dooley from the Art Center College of Design, and then Jim Thompson was supposed to be there, but never made it. I think he got caught up in travel. But really, the star of this panel was Dan Reba from DC Animated Universe. And they presented a centennial celebration of Kurtzman as possibly the most transformative figure in 20th century American humor. They investigated how American pop culture informed Kurtzman's emerging iconoclastic sensibilities, discussed Kurtzman's comics and collaborations, and examined Kurtzman's legacy in today's comics and other mass media. Now, Michael Dooley did a great job, as you would expect out of the academic on this panel, of giving us a great overview of Kurtzman's influence, lasting legacy. But the heart and soul of this panel was Dan Reba, because Dan Reba attended that same school, the Art Center College of Design. And what's notable about that is that Harvey Kurtzman, Art Spiegelman, and on top of that, Will Eisner, were at the school as faculty at the time in which Reba was there as a student, 1978 to 1981. It is. And what was really cool is that Reba remembered Art Spiegelman writing Mouse at the time. And it took him 8 years to complete Mouse. Those personal reflections, and then that of also encountering Kurtzman there. And they all mentioned that, you know, Kurtzman was the one that introduced Robert Crumb to the world. Mm-hmm. He influenced Howard Chaykin and Alan Moore. He worked with Wally Wood and depicting the horror of war in various unglamorous way. And the slideshow that accompanied this was spectacular as far as seeing the original Kurtzman art that was there. And they got into him, his career and him cutting his teeth at EC. And then they delved into Two-Fisted Tales, which really depicted the horror of war, was very influential in influencing Howard Chaykin's American Flag series. Mm-hmm. And they did, and this was really powerful, JJ, they did a panel-by-panel, side-by-side study of American Flag and also, you know, Two-Fisted. And, wow. And that was really cool. That was really cool to see. Only issue about this poor seminar was that it got interrupted by a fire alarm going off.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So we all had to evacuate, and we started heading down to the lobby area there to then exit out into that concourse, which you had mentioned before, and almost courtyard area where a lot of the cosplayers congregate. And it was a good day, and the sun was shining, and there was some slight overcast, so it wasn't all that bad. But as we were heading down the stairs, the alarm stopped. And apparently it was a false alarm. Mm. So there was only about 15 minutes left in the seminar. And I said, okay, you know, I really enjoyed the Kurtzman seminar. It was great. But if I don't get in the line to enter into the writer's panel that I was scheduled to go to next, because it immediately followed it, and it was right across the hallway, I would be kicking myself if I was not able to get a seat in there. And I'm glad I did, because it was packed to the gills. It was standing room only in the back. And there was a good reason why. This was The Right Stuff, How to Inspire Yourself. And writing is mostly a solo endeavor, and often it can be hard to get started and even more difficult to keep going. Hear from WonderCon special guests Steve Englehart, Terry Cavanaugh, David Mack, Marv Wolfman and moderated by Cecile Castellucci, How to Go from Idea to Completed Project. Now, JJ, and you experienced this yourself, and I will not spoil what you will talk about on Saturday, but very indicative of a Comic-Con experience of any kind, whether it's WonderCon, Comic-Con, or any other con, are the panelists that just hop up and join the panel that weren't previously announced.
Yep.
Boy, did we luck out on this one. We got Gail Simone to hop on the panel. So now we're up to, if memory serves me right, either five or six. And then on top of that, we got Steve Orlando.
Oh, wow.
At the very end to hop on. So
Both special guests at the convention.
Exactly. So what was amazing about this panel is that it ended up being a multi-generational panel. I think Steve Orlando was one of the youngest on there. And they all delved into the writer's experience and inspiration from everywhere is what Gail Simone said. And she needs to quiet it all down to come into focus. And she gets her inspiration from other writers, life, music, the people she interacts with. Marv Wolfman reflected and said, you know, when I take on a project, some of the first questions are, will I have fun? And is it something I would like to do? If that's the case, and generally speaking, I will have not only fun doing it, but the reader will really enjoy what I've produced and what's come out of that. He says, if you're into a character or not, you will know it if you leave in four issues. And that all got a big chuckle, but that is the truth. He said, Marv said, look, you take a look at the writers on certain series. If they last more than four issues, then you know they're onto it. If they've left after four, they weren't feeling it.
Right.
So that was great. And it said the best aspects of working in comics is about the collaborative nature of it all. Gail got assigned Bane when she was with DC. And she said, you know, I really didn't like Bane and was challenged to create a new aspect of Bane and made him to be more of a father figure. So she says, looking for what they have not done yet and make a new and engaging take is what's critical if you're going to take on a long-established character. Now, Mac had said, and his background was one of, he had written for Daredevil, and he said he needs to bring something that has not been brought before, but also respect the legacy of that character and what greatness had been accomplished before.
Exactly.
Steve Orlando went on to say, hey, the inspiration is the mortgage. He put it in very practical terms, okay? And the job is to be excited by the gig. He said, sometimes have to motivate yourself to challenge yourself to find the thing that makes the most sense for you and will inspire you. And he gave a great example about this. He said, when I was writing Supergirl with Tom King, he pitched Supergirl as an immigrant story and all about the stuff she had left behind. It's our job to find out what's interesting and exciting about a character. He says, that was a different take. And from there, that was the jumping off point. There were some really, really great takeaways here. I had a ton of notes, and everyone on the panel gave very selflessly of themselves. And I also have to give a special shout out to Gail Simone. I've always had a great amount of respect for Gail on multiple fronts. She, like predecessors, being a woman in the comic book industry has never been the easiest thing. You've always been outnumbered with regard to your male counterparts, and you've had to fight a lot harder, actually, to get recognized and be offered the good gigs. And Gail has been very good at not compromising her own principles. And that being, look, if I'm going to write a character, particularly a female character, I'm going to write that character from a feminist perspective. And she gave a prime example of this. She got offered the gig that she both loved and feared the most. She was approached to write Wonder Woman.
Oh, man.
And Gail said, oh my gosh, this is the character that I admired the most growing up as a little girl. And on top of this, I had so much respect, reverence, appreciation for George Perez and his run on Wonder Woman and what he brought to the table in redefining Diana as this defiant and strident character who stayed true to her convictions. I said, you know, I'm not going to engage here unless I can bring something new to the conversation. Well, one of the things that she brought into the conversation was how the lasso of truth was used. And immediately Steve Orlando jumped on that and said, hey, look, when we were doing Wonder Woman, Gail, we latched on to what you had done. So this is, again, passing the torch along and having reverence for what was done before you. And we actually built upon the foundation that you had established. And of course, you were building on the foundation that George Perez had established, and so on and so on. So from that standpoint, that was amazing to see that amount of respect sitting up there on that panel table. The thing on a personal note about Gail, Gail was seated right next to Marv Wolfman. Mm-hmm. Marv, unfortunately now, as he's gotten on in age, has begun losing his hearing. And Marv said effectively, hey, look, I really can't hear all that well. Gail, throughout the entire seminar, was writing down the questions that were being asked of the panelists, handing them to Marv, and very politely leaning over to Marv to whisper directly in his ear any clarifications that he needed so then he could give a very well thought out and informed answer to the questions of the panel. So from that standpoint, Gail, you're a superstar. She's great.
Absolutely. That's wonderful.
Yeah. So I had a very, very positive experience out of the two seminars that I attended. So JJ, Saturdays are normally jam-packed at the con, normally have a lot of competing seminars, and it sounds to me you hit a grand slam with the ones that you attended.
Absolutely. So I had three, and for the warm-up act, it was Tarzan and the Land That Time Forgot. So this is the regular Edgar Rice Burroughs Inc. seminar that we go to with folks that I was traveling with. So in this one, director Kevin Connor joins the team at Edgar Rice Burroughs Inc. to celebrate the 50th anniversary of his film adaptation of The Land That Time Forgot and the classic novel's centennial. So the story is 100 years old, and the celebration of the movie, which was 3 years prior to Star Wars, was 50 years old. Also, writer, producer, and former Tarzan star Wolf Larson discusses his role as head of the company's new entertainment division and exciting updates on bringing Tarzan, John Carter of Mars, and the ERB universe to life on the big and small screen. Now, what's really nice about this, they usually have some sort of giveaway. This year, it was commemorative trading cards to everybody that attended. They also had door prizes, which looked like they were different puzzles. They were Tarzan or John Carter or so forth puzzles. And it was, I didn't take a lot of notes in this one because I was so engrossed in what was going on. So they kind of divvied up the discussion. Usually there's a lot of talk about here's the books that are coming out, when they're coming out, because they're producing not only, republishing the entire catalog of Edgar Rice Burroughs novels, but with new covers, new forewords. They just finished the 23 volumes of Tarzan, and they're giving the same treatment to John Carter and the Warlord of Mars and the Barsoom series. So it can be a little dry sometimes. Well, Kevin was wonderful. Kevin talked about, and he had so many wonderful slides from his time in making the movie, The Land That Time Forgot. And it was so engaging and told so many fun, wonderful stories that I just forgot to take notes. I remember them talking about, you know, this was the 70s and there was a lot of pyrotechnics that were involved when a volcano explodes. And, you know, they were on a back lot and that stuff's just going off like right behind the main actors. There weren't any stand-ins at that point. So it was a wonderful, wonderful discussion. And honestly, it fired me up to see not only that, but the two sequels that he directed as well. Wolf Larson was going to talk about all the things that he's working on. He's come on board. Now, this is the guy that played Tarzan in the 1990s. And I think it was for, I don't remember what channel it was on, but it was a syndication of Tarzan. And he told so many hilarious stories about working with the animals that was, you know, so much a part of the filming process. He never really talked a lot about some of the stuff that was coming up. However, they did take time to talk about, there was like a teaser website for, check this out if you want to, you know, basically it's a countdown, and they're going to make a big announcement about what's going to happen with John Carter of Mars. So I signed up for it. As soon as that time comes, I'll get the email and I find out what it is. I don't know if it's a new movie. I don't know if it's a comic book or a cartoon series or what. When they let us know, you know, I'll be sure to share it.
Outstanding. So JJ, real quick, if you don't mind, what I find absolutely fascinating about this entire Edgar Rice Burroughs group, which essentially is an offshoot out of his estate, correct? That has been correct. Managing this? Okay. All right. So just for a listening audience and getting this straight, some of, if not most of, Edgar Rice Burroughs' original works are actually in the public domain. But it's my understanding that because ERB is so heavily involved in making new content and licensing, that they have no problem going after trademark infringement of these characters. And a prime example of that within the comic book industry itself was Dynamite Comics, that were trying to do, I believe it was both John Carter books and Tarzan. And although they couldn't get them on the copyright infringement, they ultimately did get them on trademark infringement of derivative material off of those characters. So there's a lesson for folks out there as far as legacy works are concerned. If you've got an active player that is out there with authority, such as ERB, just watch where you step, because they are very, very active in maintaining and preserving that legacy.
Absolutely. And they go to great lengths to continue. That's why it's called the ERB universe. They go on to continue the stories of not only main characters, but the offspring or offshoots of those main characters from the original stories and exploring the universe. They do a big job. They do a really big job at keeping it alive and keeping it relevant. So yeah, that was a good way to kick things off.
Yeah, I would say so.
So my next one, well, my next two had a common player in both, and that would be the legendary Bill Sienkiewicz. First part was an interview, and for those who don't know, his groundbreaking work on Marvel's Elektra Assassin, Daredevil Love and War, and the New Mutants just really kind of broke the bounds, you know, that would go into what is comic art, right? Really exploring the artistic aspects of it. I cut my teeth on his early work with Moon Knight, and to this day, I still love all of that work. There was a real Neil Adams feel to it, which I think he drew that way because he felt like it was the best way to get a job. But it was so good to finally see him kind of branch out into his own. Now, you had mentioned about people that weren't on the list showing up. Well, here's a person who wasn't even, to my knowledge, listed as being at the convention at all. There was no special notice. There was no anything. To do the introduction for Bill, to have Bill come out, was none other than the Todd father himself, Todd McFarlane.
Wow.
Todd, Todd gave a wonderful, like, I was sitting in my row and I looked over to my right, and in the row behind me at the very end, I'm like, that's Todd McFarlane. He was like five seats away from me, and I'm like, I better get a picture really quick. He gave a wonderful introduction, a warm introduction, a fond introduction. He, as many of the artists of that era, kind of followed on the coattails of people like Bill Sienkiewicz, really drawing from the freedom of expression that he infused into his art. And it was absolutely amazing. So what I took away from this is he didn't try to break the rules, but there are times where he felt he had to poke the bear. Mm-hmm. So he would do things to see how far he could go. He can do the corporate shtick, but he is very much a non-corporate person. And this totally sums it up. To him, drawing is like jazz. Very much in the moment. He draws what the character feels like. What the character feels like. He told a story of how, as an artist, you'll do pre-work. You'll get ideas. You'll do sketches. You do all this. And then when he sits down to draw, if he doesn't feel it, he can't draw. And if something totally different comes up that he did not prepare for, he has to honor that and go with that. And he's done that before, where he's thrown out all of his pre-work and taking the work into a totally different direction. He had worked on and really got the feel of the characters for Moon Knight for 3 years, and then they offered him the X-Men.
Wow.
Yeah, they offered him the X-Men, like the flagship book
of
Marvel in the 80s. And he said he felt he might drive it into a ditch.
He just
wanted to do painted covers.
Right.
He just wanted to play. And then as a result of that, they offered him a 3-issue arc on the New Mutants with the Demon Bear.
Okay.
But he had such fun doing that he stayed on and just did whatever he wanted. I mean, that's part of the thing. This was before you really had style sheets. Now, if you were going to draw the New Mutants have style sheets, and you have to kind of adhere to what that style is.
Sure.
And really, I wouldn't say draw the house style, but the characters have to be recognizable. He had one of the most, a character who defied description and defied the idea of a style sheet, because he never looked the same way twice, in Warlock.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of broke the mold with that one.
And JJ, I'll also say this. The first time I was aware of Bill Sienkiewicz was in the Marvel Dune adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
Of the Lynch movie.
Mm-hmm.
And because his work was viewed as being so iconic and associated then from Dune, Herbert and Frank and now his son have kept Bill in the fold. And he is the one who's done all of the covers thus far for the literary graphic novel adaptation of Dune, which has recently come out. So it's amazing when you're bringing up the fact that he described himself as being a jazz artist, mm-hmm. and needing to be inspired. Mm-hmm. Well, there are some sources of inspiration that just keep on giving for him. And that has certainly been one where he has really made a name for himself within that fandom.
Absolutely. And he has gone on to do lots of album covers, the book covers. He loves painting. He is a painter at heart. And so being able to explore the painted medium which gives him so much more freedom than purely illustrative, as would be done in comics. Just amazing. Not too long ago, last year, as a matter of fact, when we were talking about Fire and Ice and the Frank Frazetta stuff, he's doing the covers for that series. So, oh, nice. I mean, he's you know, he is recognized as a legend. And it was just so, so good to just, he's so down to earth, so fun to talk to. Well, talk to in the sense of, it felt like a conversation, even though I was, you know, in the audience. When he does album artwork, he just plays the music over and over. When he did the Jimi Hendrix comic, he was listening to Jimi Hendrix all the time.
Nice.
So yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Well, you know, and JJ, I have to say, you know, that speaks volumes that Todd McFarlane, now I know Todd lives in Arizona, so it's not too far of a trip for him, but still, the fact that Todd would take of his time, knowing that at WonderCon there was going to be this panel celebrating Bill Sienkiewicz's career like this, and that he would then offer to introduce them, that just speaks volumes as to how the artistic community views Bill. Because with McFarlane, you know, he made a name for himself doing Spider-Man over Marvel, and then, of course, being one of the founders and really the heartbeat of Image Comics.
Right.
And then McFarlane Toys. So if you want to talk about a Titan just within geekdom, you know, it doesn't get any bigger than Todd McFarlane, you know, who also happens to be a big baseball seam head there, having played it as an amateur player and really had dreams of one day becoming a professional baseball player. So, you know, all of that being said, I think that it's just so cool that he would be there to support Bill. And at this stage in his career, I'm sure many of these folks are thinking legacy. And the fact that he would take the time to celebrate Bill's is pretty huge. That's awesome. That's a class act right there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Bill is the tie-in to my last one. Now, he wasn't the front person on this one. He wasn't the front man on it. My last seminar was In Conversation with Bruce Dickinson, the Mandrake Project. So for folks who don't know, Bruce Dickinson is a front man for Iron Maiden. And even after Maiden, he kept making music. So his latest project is a series of comics called The Mandrake Project. It's going to be 12 issues, and it's the saga about the century-long battle for the human control of immortality. So he just released the album, The Mandrake Project, and that coincided with the release of the second issue of the comic, and the comic is produced by Z2 Publications. So on hand were Rance Bosley, he's an Emmy Award-winning editor, and Josh Bernstein, a Ringo Award-winning editor, both from Z2. The moderator, here's that music theme again, was none other than Ryan J. Downey of MTV News. So again, we've got, here's that joining of comics and music, right? We were already talking about Bill Sienkiewicz, that, you know, when he did the album covers, he would listen to the music and do the album covers. So now he's doing the covers of this series, beautiful painted covers of this series. And it was wild. It was just wild. There were so many Iron Maiden fans in attendance. It was absolutely amazing. Just devoted fans. And Bruce was just such an entertainer. Like, just kept people engaged in telling the story of how he came up with this and, you know, how he came to want to get it published, and the story that he's been working on for probably about a decade on and off. And then when he sat down and he felt like he had to pitch it to Bill, he's like, oh my God, this is Bill Sienkiewicz. I mean, he knew who he was. He knew who he was. And he's like, oh, I got to pitch this to him. How do I pitch the Mandrake Project to Bill Sienkiewicz? And Bill was like, I'm in. Like, instantly. I'm in. And it was wonderful. But he talked about his love of comics. Okay. Bruce talked about his love of comics. And you'll like this. Such a fan of Doctor Strange.
Nice. Yes. So that warms my heart.
So growing up in England, it was harder for him to get the comics, but he said he was a fan of Doctor Strange because, well, Doctor Strange could control everything, and him being a kid who could control nothing, of course, that's something really cool.
Right.
Silver Surfer, because Silver Surfer was always pissed off, and, you know, so was Bruce. He's like, oh, I can really relate to this guy. And then the Human Torch was his other one because,
hell,
he wanted to be able to burn things. So
there you go.
Yeah. But he always, he still loved comics until music kind of took over his life and then kind of pushed comics out of the way. So he talked about his favorite Doctor Strange story, If Eternity Should Fail. And eventually that led to him writing a song that was covered by Iron Maiden. But he had a slide up with the picture of the splash page from that comic. And Josh Bernstein was there, and he's one of the editors for Z2 Comics. And he says, hey, Bruce, I got you a present. While we were here, I went out and I found that comic on the dealer floor. And I've got it for you here. So presented him with the Doctor Strange comic that was his, I mean, he was flabbergasted. He could not believe that somebody did that. I mean, he is such a fan.
That's awesome.
He actually encountered Bill Sienkiewicz and became aware of Bill Sienkiewicz during his run on Rom the Space Knight. So there was so much good stuff. He talked about his discovery of William Blake. Well, he was looking, like, he opened up an album. I don't remember the album, but he said it was a metal album, and there was an image of Nebuchadnezzar by William Blake. And, like, that sent him down this William Blake trail. And during COVID, he started really coming back to these themes that he had been working on for a while. And that really kind of culminated not only in his album Chemical Wedding, get this, he's restoring Blake's cottage in England.
Whoa!
He's restoring the cottage so that it can become a little cultural center and folks can come and, you know, explore William Blake. I mean, it's amazing.
So this sounds to me what Bruce Dickinson is doing for Blake is exactly what Don Henley did.
Yep.
So it's very cool to see these very gifted and legendary musicians finding inspiration and celebrating the works of legacy artists, whether they be writers, poets, you name it, and really investing themselves in that. That is so cool. I've always liked Bruce. I've always been very, very impressed with Iron Maiden as a whole, because they're really a prog metal band at their heart. I mean, they unabashedly said, oh yeah, we're big fans of Yes, and but we play things hard here because we came up during that whole, you know, new wave of British heavy metal movement. But they're so much more than that. And their legacy and fan base just so endures. And you were there sitting with them, and you had your own, you know, Up the Irons epic moment there.
Yes.
Which was really, really cool. That's very cool.
Yep. So, of course, my last stop in the hall was to go down to Z2's booth and pick up issues 1 and 2 of the Mandrake Project.
And nice.
Beautiful covers by Bill Sienkiewicz. I haven't gotten into them yet. I want to really give them time. I want to explore the books. I want to listen to the album because they've got to relate to each other, right? He put all of this in here, and it's just so much, it's so exciting. You know, I haven't really been excited about a new product in a long time. Now, this is really going to test my patience because the comics only come out quarterly, and at the year's end, they'll collect those 4 issues into a graphic novel. So it's going to be 3 years in the making, 12 issues.
Nice.
Yeah. And this was a beautiful touch. The comics are square, like an album cover.
Ooh.
Yeah. Now, okay. They're not actual album size. They're slightly smaller than that. But it is a square format, and it just, again, bridging comics and music. It's so, for it's such a silent art form, right, to draw upon the music so much and really use it as an inspiration was really, you know, just, it was infectious to be in there, and, you know, I really wanted to succeed. Looks like his album is placing in the tops of the charts in Europe. So he's on tour right now. Amazing stuff. Absolutely amazing stuff. So I'm very excited to see how the Mandrake Project goes.
That just sounds spectacular. And, you know, I have to say, you know, all in all, I think we both had pretty positive experiences at, you know, this year's WonderCon. Quality of the, from the quality of the seminars to the exhibit hall itself. Just really, really good stuff. You have any last impressions or words for our audience as far as WonderCon, who it's really geared towards and for, and, you know, what they could really get out of it?
Really, if you're a fan of comics and pop culture media, do yourself a favor, check it out. There's so much to explore. You and I can barely scratch the surface on all the seminars that happen. And this is an opportunity to get, in most cases, into a very intimate setting. You know, there's maybe a couple hundred people in a room at most. These weren't like gigantic halls. So you could get up close and personal with these creators and really, really experience something more. Get something more out of your favorite pop culture idea, comic, music, everything. There's something here for everybody.